Hello, everyone. Welcome to a spooky edition of ARG Presents. I'm your boy, your good friend, Migo Aaron, joined by a man who's haunted me for far too long. I give you the spectral vision that is the Brent.
I will haunt you in life and death.
That's a happy thought. Thank you very much, yes. Brent. Very good. So, if you tuned in last week, we spun the wicked wheel. We made the unholy deal. And this week, we're going to be playing games on the much celebrated, for its time, ZX81, the Sinclair, yes. ZX81, or ZX81, or ZX81, if you're in the States. Brent, I doubt you knew much about the old Sinclair ZX81, did you?
I didn't. No, I mean, we obviously have played with the Spectrum in mass.
By Spectrum, you mean the ZX Spectrum, which was the follow-up to the ZX81.
Obviously, yes. And I knew there were computers before it, obviously, but that has always had my focus.
Mm. Well, you know, it's funny. I knew about the ZX through one simple reason. When me and Boat started getting into the British computers, I just assumed one size fit all. And so when I saw ZX81, I almost bought one because thinking it was a Spectrum. And thank God I did a little research at the time because that would have been quite a shock. There's quite a few differences between the ZX81 and the Speccy.
Yeah.
But one thing we want to talk about here is how we got here to the ZX81. You know, Sir Clive Sinclair, the man behind the Sinclair technologies and all of Sinclair's industrial efforts, this guy didn't know jack squat about computers. Let's make that abundantly clear. But what he did know was how to sell product.
This sucker knew how to sell. He was a marketing madman.
That's right.
Yes.
And he knew that to make the big money, you price that crap cheap, dirt cheap.
Yep.
And so you can't talk about the Sinclair ZX81 without talking about the Sinclair ZX80, which again, Brent, much like the NASCOM that we covered a few weeks ago, was sold as a kit. The original ZX80, and was the first personal computer ever sold for under 100 pounds, an incredible feat.
Yeah.
You could get this thing in kit form. I believe it was 79 pounds.
I believe you're correct.
And then you could get the computer pre-assembled for 100 pounds or 99 pounds. A remarkable achievement. Now, what did you get for your money? And Roy, we could talk about these sort of interchangeably because there's a lot of similarities between the two. What you got for your money was a very small unit with basically no frills. The ZX80 was made for cost effectiveness.
Yes.
It was so cheap, Brent, that they didn't even use actual screws in it. They used plastic pegs.
Yeah, don't need screws. Screws cost too much.
That's right. Another thing that they didn't have, and this the ZX80 and 81 didn't have this, is they most machines of the time would use a female slot connector on the back so you could accommodate a cartridge or a peripheral. The ZX80 and the 81 actually use an edge connector they want to pay for the female edge connector. They've just got an edge connector on the back, so you have to put that thing in the cartridge or peripheral. Wacky. So, but what did the ZX81 bring to the table? Well, they consolidated a bunch of chips into one chip, so they had that going for them. They also doubled the ROM in it.
One thing about the chips that needs to be mentioned to understand how incredible it was, they went from 40 chips in the original ZX80 down to 4 chips in the ZX81. That's amazing.
They consolidated a lot of chips into one big chip. It was very, very impressive. One thing that I thought was interesting about the ZX80 and 81 is they have a port, very few ports, but they had a port for a microphone. They had a port for the cassette output, input, and then they also had a port for power. All three ports were the same 1/8-inch jack ports. So you could actually plug in the power to the cassette port, for example, any of the cassette ports. That I often wonder if that would cause anything to happen if you put power into the wrong port. So that was a problem. But the ZX81 had a slightly improved keyboard. And, of course, Sinclair always had those little basic keyboard commands that were, like, shortened on the keyboard, which was, you know, helpful if you're going to program, especially on that godforsaken membrane keyboard. The overall, though, this machine was a much more usable machine, and they did a lot with it, didn't they, Brent?
They did, yeah.
What's
funny is they, you know, when most people look at the keyboard looks crazy busy, right?
Yeah.
Clive took that and made it into a marketing gimmick. He said, yeah, like, if you're going to program on this thing, half the steps are already done. They're all hotkeyed in. It's awesome. That, you know, when anyone else would look at that keyboard and think, oh, my God, what's going on? But, yeah, he actually sold that, and it helped. It helped it because it allowed your common man who knew nothing of computers. This is, you know, the ZX81 launched March 5th of 81, and it allowed the common man to feel more comfortable that he was going to be able to get this machine and do things with it. And that went a long way with marketing to help sell the machine.
You know, one thing I was reading and watching videos and doing research for this that struck me was that a lot of people, it seems like the ZX80 and 81 had sort of the same, they got sort of the same treatment that the Coco did in a lot of ways, in that they were sort of ridiculed. And as time has went on, they've gotten hassled. I don't think people understand the significance of a computer that you could have at your house for that price. I mean, it's amazing.
And we didn't mention the actual price of the 81. The 81 sold ready to go for £70. And in kit form, you could get it as low as £50.
Yeah, remarkable. So you're talking, I think that's, and if you put that in U.S. money, you're probably a couple $100 and you're in. And that's amazing. Again, for people that weren't around back then, it's hard to envision this, and you know, but I mean, the thought of having I was alive when no one had a personal computer. I remember being at school watching a thing on Bell Laboratories, that they had this big computer and making this big deal out of it. You know, like, man, they've got this huge computer. And no one ever thought they were going to have a computer at the house, ever. Yeah. That never occurred to anybody. And so all of a sudden, this thing comes around at that price. And that is remarkable, man.
And here's something to put that in perspective. Some other computers that were selling around the same time, the absolute next cheapest computer was the Dragon 32, okay?
Which and it roughly was selling, say it was a Coco, yeah,
for $175. Okay, now that's almost double the price,
right?
And when you think about that, what more do you get? You get
color,
a few more things. You get color on your screen, stuff like that. The next step up, though, outside of the VIC-20, which was obviously super popular, after you get out of that range, you start talking 3, 4, 10 times the price. So this computer coming out at this price point made it highly accepted and purchased throughout the UK and property or territories, because it allowed people who had no idea what a computer was to take a risk. I mean, sure, that's still a lot of money, but it's far less than, say, the Apple II Plus, which was selling for, you know, $1,300 at the time. That's how you have to compare this kind of thing. Sure, was the Apple II Plus more powerful? Of course it was. But at, 13 times the price, you would expect it to be. So this took as much computer technology, and by the way, the Z80 chip, holy crap, we need to do a whole show on just the Z80 chip. It's the best thing ever.
It was in everything.
But to take all that computer power and get it into a sub-100 price tag is extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary.
I agree. Yeah, we should also mention that one of the improvements the ZX81 had over the 80 was just it looked a lot better.
Yeah.
I think this case, if I'm not mistaken, was designed by Rick Dickinson, who went on to design the Spectrum. And he also, I'm pretty sure he was the fellow that also designed the Spectrum Next that just came out. I believe he just passed away recently. But yeah, this was a good-looking case. These things are incredibly small, something that can't be understood. They're real small. I mean, there's not much to them. They're very impressive.
They weigh less than a pound.
And
the whole computer minus power supply weighs less than a pound.
Hey, let me ask you. You know, we just covered the NASCOM a couple weeks ago. And, of course, I'd heard of the ZX81. I had never heard of the NASCOM. But we got to get in there and get intimate with both of them. And this is no disrespect to the ZX81, but I think the NASCOM sort of held its own with this machine in a lot of ways. And it makes you wonder what could have been. What do you think about that?
I agree. Both systems definitely had their flaws. For example, the ZX81, while highly moddable, I mean, people were selling almost proper keyboards for these things instead of membrane keyboards. And you could do that since it was a kit computer. You could put all this new crazy stuff on there, and in that way, it was a lot like the NASCOM. But where the ZX81 really had its failings was its power supply. So much so that when this was sold in big box stores, you know, this was the first computer that was on the shelf that you could purchase, you know, in the UK. Go to a store and purchase, not mail order or anything like that. The stores would actually order 33% more than they thought they could sell because they knew the return was going to be high for failed power supply.
That's a Sinclair trademark. It seems like that's happened on a lot of their machines. Of course, I was in manufacturing. You were briefly. And when you're manufacturing something very technical and very outside your scope, you're going to have those sorts of issues from a manufacturing perspective because especially something like this, that doesn't surprise me that much, to be honest with you.
Sure. And for the power supply, you can kind of blame it on manufacturing. But the second large failing point was a flaw in the actual ZX81's design with, as you said, not having an actual port in the back and just having the card stick out. People would fry their memory modules and sometimes the computers themselves all the time from that thing slipping off.
Oh, yeah. I've read people talk about
so much
about
so
that. Yeah.
That they would actually take tacking glue and the tacking putty and put it in between the memory module and the computer to basically fuse the two together.
I do recall hearing something about that because the way that thing sits on the back there, since the slot is on the peripheral, not on the machine, it that causes problems, especially those are going to get loose after a while. And really, a memory addition to this thing is almost mandatory because
it's pretty needed.
1K is very little. I should mention before we move into the games here that if you had a ZX80. And you were looking enviously at the 81. You were not out of the loop. They released a ROM upgrade and a keyboard overlay, and you were good to go. That's how similar they were. So you were actually good to go if you swapped out that memory or swapped out that ROM chip. So you could. I would wager the majority of ZX80s walking around these days probably had that done to them by now. Had them upgraded. So really, you've got two different ZX81s, the 80s and the 81s. Kind of neat. It's a neat little machine, I have to say.
Yeah. And do you know why the original ZX80 sold 500,000 units when it first came out, right? The 81, I believe the number was 1.5 million. And the price point was so low that these started showing up in schools. And that is how a lot of kids was introduced to computers, was this thing. Because it was cheap enough that you could throw a couple of these in the classroom and be okay. Brilliant move is exactly what you needed to do. So, I mean, we talk to people all the time. It's like, this was my first computer or this was my first computing experience. And the reason why is they could, the price point was so cheap, you could get these into places that you couldn't get a computer into normally.
Yeah.
So it was all part of Sinclair's vision. I was watching a thing up until, you know, a few years ago, well, many years ago at this point, Clive admitted, he said, I can't do anything on these things. I've never learned to program them. You know, that wasn't my thing. My thing was to make us look like the underdog, make us look like a small family company, get the price down to where we could put this in every home. And that's what he did. And his marketing strategy was brilliant. And the computers were good enough that the marketing strategy worked. So when you have both of those in combination, you've got a pretty winning combination.
You know, I should mention, and I'm not going to get into this too much because this could be something we cover on a future show, but the ZX81s did make it to the States in the 80s to a certain degree, and under the guise of the Timex Sinclair 1000 series, which I will say that was, those were the butt of the joke over here for a while.
Yes.
because they were known for not being very good computers. And they sold for, I mean, I remember seeing these things get blown out when I was a kid. For like 60, 50, 60, 70 bucks. And I mean, you could, I remember seeing a plastic tub of them, like in the middle of like one of the retail shops with just like boxes of them in there. I mean, cause you could, and they weren't that big. In some ways the Timex Sinclairs, were slightly improved from the ZX, but they were mostly the same, but, somewhere down the road,
they were, but they also had severe, fail rates.
Well, we should mention that Timex actually were the manufacturers of these, so they probably didn't help. It's funny because Timex is sort of known, at least in America, for making quality watches. I wouldn't say expensive ones, but quality. So you would think that they would, but this is a long way from watchmaking. Talk about retooling your assembly line.
Yeah. One last thing we have to mention before we get into the game, and this will be the last thing we'll get onto the games. The ZX81 had a math failing. It actually, if you took the square root, oh man, I cannot remember the number now.
I saw this. It's like one. The answer should have been, I think,
1.5.
And it ended up being 1.238672. Whatever. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
You remember a few years ago when that happened to one of the Pentium line? They had they had an issue. I can't remember which one it was.
Hey, math is hard.
Even for the computer, right?
That's right.
So, with all that said, a very interesting machine. We have really had a good time looking into research on this. But with all that said, it was time to pick a couple games to look at on this thing. I'm going to start the charge this week with my selection. I had to look around, and this is a machine that me and Brent have no prior experience on. And so we didn't know what the good games were, the bad games. I just sort of tried to pick something that looked like it was my type of game. That's the best I could come up with. And what I ended up coming up with was a game called 49er. Niner.
Yes.
As they say, 49er. 49er, a game that was published by I love the name of this place, the Cosmic Cockerel, which is a chicken, and it, which apparently they eventually turned into the Software Farm. So either way it goes, a stupid name.
They love the farm animal.
Yeah. So this came out in 1984. So this is an exceptionally late release. And the reason I picked this game was this game was one of the first games that did something that no one thought the ZX81 could do, which was produce high-res graphics. All right?
Yeah.
This thing required the 16K attachment, okay, obviously, which a lot of stuff did.
Which almost everything did, yeah.
And this game could run in high-res graphics. The majority of graphics on this machine, including the ones that are going to be featured in your game later, were made up of like keyboard characters and those pre-rendered little shapes that would come with the machine. The C64 is famous for those. The little things that you could see on the key, it would have the different little graphics. Those, it would come with almost like ANSI. But this is a game that actually ran in a high-res mode, which was unthinkable at the time. Now, keep in mind that in 84, I believe that the ZX Spectrum was released in 83.
It was.
So, yeah. So it, by this time, the 81 was on its way out the door. So this would have been still quite a remarkable thing.
84 is when it got discontinued.
Yeah. So there you go. So what do you got here with this game? Well, I found a blurb that sort of describes what exactly you're doing, because it's kind of hard to tell right out of the gate. So I'm just going to read this verbatim. In 1849, the Great American Gold Rush started. Almost everyone who could sold up everything and went out west for the precious metal, including you. You must evacuate the precious metal. No, excuse me. That didn't sound right. You must excavate the precious. You don't want to evacuate it. That's no good. You must excavate this precious metal, but can you survive the giant rats and the vicious gremlin which come to infest your mind? That was a problem back in the 1840s. But the gremlins were everywhere in California. Can you trick the snakes into leaving their comfortable nests and destroying the rats for you? Can you keep the gremlin at bay? Riches await you, but so do the hazards. There you go. So this is a game where you play the 49er, which is another term for just a gold prospector from back in the day. You've got to dig through the earth to dig up the giant gold nuggets. And as you go through, you also will be posting up support beams, all right, because you got to have those to keep your cave up. As you go to the ground, you're going to come through rats' nests, and the rats are going to come out. Which that probably did. That's probably something that did happen in mining, but big bunch of rats down there. So the funny thing about this game is you have an unlikely ally in large underground snakes.
Yes,
very strange to me. So this is a game in your classic sort of dig-dug perspective. You've got a miner that digs through the earth. You're going to see on the screen, at the top of the screen, there's like a big mountain. Then you're underneath the ground, and then to the left of the mountain is a little pile of dots. So your job is to dig through this earth and go towards the gold nuggets. So they look like little white wads, basically. As you go through, you're going to see it. You're only going to see a few different things in the ground, but they're pretty easy to pick out. You see the nuggets. You see this sort of almost like a flashing Z's that are in the ground. And then you see these raised areas, like these miscolorations of pixels that move around. These are the rats. And so the way this game works is as you dig through the soil, rats, they move. They move around underground. And so when they come into your tunnel, you can see them, and they start chasing you or walking around. The miscolored shapes that you see are the rats that are still in the dirt. Like I said, they move around. Yeah. Now, what do? You're a miner. You've only got a couple options here to get these rats off of you. One is you can turn around and you can sort of whack your support beams, that, and they'll make the cave sort of cave in. And when you do that, the rats, it doesn't kill them, but it does slow them down. They don't move as quickly underground as they do in your tunnel. And I should mention, they move pretty quick in the tunnel, don't they?
Like, yeah, they're slightly faster than your character. They'll catch you.
So you can kick the beams. The other more hilarious way to get rid of these guys is to release the snakes. The flashing Z's are snakes that are coiled up underground. And what you can do is, if you lead a bunch of rats to where the snake's at and angle it right, when you dig through the snake, he'll just shoot it straight out, and he'll eat anything in the way. Now, he doesn't shoot out right away. It takes him a second to uncoil. So if you've got a rat directly on you, you're probably still sort of boned. But if the rats are a little bit piece away from you, then the snake will come up and eat them. There are usually several snakes per level, and there are a ton of rats that come out. So how do you get off a level? Well, you've got to collect all the gold nuggets. And when you do that, a mine door will appear at the bottom right of the screen, and you've got to go into the door. Now, this can be a tricky situation, because I have found that there's plenty of times where you walk into the door and you can't actually get in because you have to come in at a certain angle. And that's one thing that haunts this game, which I'll get into in a minute. Now, I would be amiss if I didn't mention the giant gremlin at the top of the screen. So up on the top of the screen is a big pile of, it looks like a mountain. And there's a freak that just bounces around with a big gaping mouth, and that's all he does. But what he's doing is actually eating your dirt pile at the top of the screen. That dirt pile's there for a reason, because it keeps that guy from coming into the mine, okay? So periodically, you've got to come back up to the surface and dump some dirt off to keep your dirt pile large enough. If you don't, this thing will eventually eat through all your dirt, and then he'll come into the mine, right? This is no good. Because he can't be hurt. He's a killer gremlin. Now, I didn't find this guy to be too difficult to deal with, but he becomes a bigger problem as you get further into the game because the dirt pile gets smaller and smaller. And then once he gets in there, he'll come get you. You're pretty much boned. This game, there's actually a lot going on in it. I mean, they don't really introduce anything different as you go on. It's just more of the same. But the rats are more numerous. The rats just on level one are already deadly enough. I mean, this is a game that it was not easy, was it, Brent?
And no, and some of it was cheapness. Like, you can start and a rat be so close to you that you can't get away.
Absolutely.
But most of the time, a majority of the time, it starts off in a fair position and you can actually play the level.
What did you think of this one, Brent? Again, we've never played or heard of these games. What were your impressions on this one?
Well, I'm assuming you're going to go over this, but the biggest failing of the game, and I let me
I know
up.
What you're going to say, but yeah, please.
I shouldn't start by killing it. Because this was, this had a few aspects that were freaking amazing. Having the dirt piles of the rats as they dig underground, where you can see them, like, it looks like they're burrowing through. Amazing.
Yeah. That's beautiful, a good effect. Cut. Yeah, especially, yeah. It's simple, too. It's a simple effect. They just raise a little cursor area of graphics and make them slightly different. That's all it takes, and you can see them burrowing. It's a really good effect.
Yeah, it's excellent. It's excellent. Having the snakes chase after the rats, I thought was a really nice touch. Normally, your snakes are enemies in a game, and I was very confused when I first started playing of why weren't the snakes killing me.
Right.
But they are solely there to use as a weapon. Yeah. This is very much a reverse Dig Dug, where
it's exactly,
things go up instead of going down.
That's exactly. They're like the rocks in Dig Dug. They're exactly correct. The way I thought of it. Yeah.
And everything looks good. The rats look really, really good. Yeah. Your guy looks good. He's well animated. Of course, there is no sound.
Yeah, there's no sound.
Something with the ZX81 is the only sound it could produce was from the tape player. So most things didn't take any type of advantage
of that. I did read that they could switch. The ZX81 had a thing called slow mode and fast mode. Unlike the original ZX80 only had fast mode. And you would think slow mode would be bad, but it actually, they used it to have the processor do multiple tasks. And I read somewhere that that someone came up with a way that if you switch between these modes real fast, you could make this thing generate some sort of sound over the RF. So
yes, that's true. But it was, I didn't run into anything that actually used it.
So
I don't know how late into the cycle that was even a thing.
And apparently they even had a sound edition, but apparently nothing used that either. So, yeah.
Right. But, I mean, that's not what we're talking about. You know, the sound of this was obviously not important for its product. The issue with this game, and I had a lot of fun playing this, I thought it was fun to complete levels. It did kind of suck that progression only meant that the goblin was a little bit faster at getting into the mine, and Grimly. That the rats and stuff were just more numerous. I wish they would maybe not introduce the rats at first or mixed it up a little bit. It's just the progression doesn't feel great. But the biggest problem with the game is your character is 2 segments tall, and he is only 1 segment wide. And the reason why this is an issue is when you're moving around the level and you go up and down, left and right, it does not work well. I think a better solution would have been to make him either square 2 segments and 2 segments, or just 1 segment. Because you get a lot of in-between issues with him being too tall and only 1 wide. And it's not a ton of a problem, but it can be an issue. Especially when you're talking coming into the door, you have to line it up correctly because you can't be a segment off. And the other issue with the game is like something I said before. It's random where it puts the nuggets and the rats and the snakes. And sometimes that randomness means a rat is so close to you that the game starts and then it instantly kills you.
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head there. And the thing is, that don't get it twisted. The guy looks great. You show him, he digs with his hands. It looks good.
Yes.
But where he's a little bit taller, not all of his body is in play, I guess is the best way to put it. And so sometimes, for example, you could run right over a nugget and not get it because you didn't perfectly run over the nugget, just like the doors. Also, the snakes, exact same way. You could think you got the snakes perfectly and you didn't get it. What would have probably helped is if they had just made this guy half as tall. Right? Now, the flip side of
is 1 segment tall.
The problem with that would have been he wouldn't look as cool because there's no way you could animate him as well given those parameters. So I can see why they did it this way. And once you play this for a while, I'm not going to say, you get used to it, but by that, I mean, you just get used to getting screwed, basically, because you know that, it's going to happen.
You accept the limitations.
Yeah, like, when I first played this, I couldn't leave. And I thought, what did I do wrong? Well, it wasn't because I couldn't leave. It's because I was trying to go down into the door, and you can't do that. You got to come through the front of the door.
Oh, yeah, you definitely can't
do that. So stuff like that, like collision issues. And I'm not going to call it collision detection, because I'm not sure it's that advanced. It's just the way it is, I guess is the best way to put it. But all that said, and if you're looking at this or have played this before, you're probably thinking to yourself, this looks like some kind of Dig Dug knockoff. It doesn't really play anything like Dig Dug. I mean, it really doesn't. Yeah. It's its own game. I'll give it credit for that. You know, it's its own game. It's a unique game. It was there's a lot of stuff going on the screen. But if you have to get past the limitations of the graphical issues that are in there, because that is the biggest failing of the game. All that said,
and when you
go ahead,
when you take a step back and you realize that this is for the ZX81, that's mind blowing.
Right, with a 16K expansion, because again, this was a machine that wasn't let me just put it this way: on the original ZX80. Whenever you typed in text and hit enter, the whole screen would flash because there is no video output. It's basically sharing the video output with the processor. That's how remedial it was, you know. Yeah. And so you're really pushing this thing to the limits with a game like this. Do you have so this one you would give the thumbs up to, Brent, or not?
Here's the thing: if you were looking at ZX81 games, right? Yeah. And you wanted something that was entertaining to play and I feel pushed the system hard to its max, I think this is a good look. I would not go out of my way to hunt this game out down. I don't think it did anything that special to make it worth seeking out.
Yeah.
But if you're looking for ZX81 games, absolutely give this a shot. If you've got the emulator already up and running, give this a look.
Beautiful. So we did get a review on this one from our good buddy Z9K9, who writes, "It's a solid game design with elements in balance and interesting decisions to make. Unfortunately, the controls and collision detection are on the woolly side. There's a lot of hidden learning and knowing exactly how to touch things to make sure they get triggered off. That's true. We talked about that. E.g. the snakes. And even then, they still feel unreliable, though more play might resolve this. Interestingly, when the Gremlin reaches the left edge of the left edge, it's not a timeout and game over as the instructions led me to expect, but instead he runs rampant through the level, devouring all the earth and turning it into an open battle arena, which is a much more interesting outcome, I agree. Full credit for technical achievement. If Ty is a game which tries to maximize its creativity within the accepted technical limitations, this is a game which strains against those limitations and succeeds at the cost to the game itself. 7 out of 10. Oh, well written.
I agree with all of that.
Not well read, but well written testimonial on that particular game. We've also got an entry here from Paul, a.k.a. Hermsky. He gives us a Herm firm 8 out of 10, Brent. At first glance, you may think, meh, but you have to appreciate the limitations and the expectations of the ZX81. This computer was designed to be the first affordable home computer here in the UK, with the exception of the ZX80. Uncle Clive didn't have the games industry in mind when he built this. It was meant to aid education and small businesses with simple applications. Well, that definitely helped us 80s kids persuade our parents to buy one. These games were written by youngsters who had no prior knowledge of coding. This was the first time for many successful game designers got to experiment. It was never taught in school. Instead, studying experimentation with basic programming manual in dark, cold bedrooms is all we had to go by. When you see some of these games on the ZX81, you can instantly see they're the backbone of many future game ideas that we all grew up to love, 49er included. This game is a prime example and a superb work of art, a very addictive little underground game for its time. Only gripe I have is that the game could not exit the levels vertically. You have to hit them from the left. Yes, I understand that. These games really did have Sir Clive Sinclair spitting dummies. There you go. We've also got a review from Frodo NL. Frodo writes, given that the ZX81 does not have a graphics mode, this was an amazing feat. High resolution graphics had not been seen before in ZX81 games. Even looking back now, it's still amazing that the Cosmic Cockerel / Software Farm was able to do this without any additional hardware apart from the 16K RAM expansion, of course. Even better, though, the game is actually fun to play. Of course, there is no color, but the graphics are very recognizable. The only issue I have with the game occurs when a rat happens to be very close when the player starts, especially possible when you just lost a life. That can make the game pretty much unplayable and make one lose the rest of their lives. This is a small issue, though. Extra points for having redefinable keys. That's true. And a five-slot high-score table. 8.5 out of 10, Brent. So we got a lot of good action on the old ZX81 this week.
Absolutely.
I concur with all. I think those guys all nailed it, and I pretty much covered the same points we did. A technical marvel and a fun game, although a bit limited by its own technical achievement, I think. So, with all that in mind, Brinster, you picked something completely different. What do you got for us this week?
I brought the game Ty to the table. And Ty is a shooter game where you are the last of a people and you are trying to stop the Imperial fleet from making it to the main planets, because if the Imperial fleet makes it to the main planets,
that's it.
Life as you know it is over. This obviously took some inspiration from the Star Wars films, and we'll get into that in a little bit. This was designed by Brian Burdett and was published by the PSS in 1983. The PSS is the Personal Software Service, and they ran up until 1987, where they were acquired by MirrorSoft. Oh. And the guy actually admits that the whole reason why they kind of fell apart was he took his eye off the ball. He said, you know what? Early in the career, I was focused on these 8-bit computers, and I was putting amazing stuff out there. He was putting war games and stuff that really hadn't been seen. And the guy said, I lost focus, and then we just kind of fell apart and got taken over. So it's good to see when a person of that power understands where they failed.
Yeah.
So I wanted so badly to interview the creator of Ty, Brian Burdett. His son was found online, and this was the only game Brian ever did. Although there is an unreleased game that Brian made called Donkey Derby, which was a gambling type game.
Oh, we
got to
see that someday.
Never released, unfortunately. And the only existing copies are believed lost.
Oh, man.
Drew stated. But let's talk. Let's not look at the sadness. Let's look at the goodness. And let's take a look at Ty. In Ty, you are a spaceship. And in the very beginning of the game, you're flying through this ghost canyon. And you have to eliminate enough ghosts to clear your path to fly out into space so you can take on the evil empire. And you fly through a repeating canyon, a la River Raid style, just that kind of perspective. Your ship is about a third of the way up the screen. It can't move up and down. It can only move left and right and shoot. And you are tasked to get a score of 20 by eliminating ghosts and fireballs. And once you do that, it clears the path and lets you fly up to space. Something that needs to be said about this game, the scrolling, super smooth for what we're working with. Everything, the graphics in this area work. You feel like you're flying through this canyon of the dead. The canyon has skull shapes and ruins and cities built into the wall, and it all looks awesome. It all looks awesome. The skull is this mountain, a fixture in the middle of the cavern, or the middle of the ravine, I should say, looks incredible. And this was all hand-drawn on graph paper. His son says that his father had a roll of graph paper that he would lay out, you know, feet long, because the stage loops. So you got to get all of this lined up to begin with to find out where your looping point's going to be and everything. And it's all built with characters that the keyboard can produce. It does not fight the restrictions of the system. It works with what it can do. So you're flying this ship, and your ship has a number on it. It's how many hits you can take before you crash and burn. You got to start over. And it's got a little engine exhaust, and you're firing your bullets, and you're shooting your ghost. And eventually, once you clear enough out, you clear the path, you get a launch into space. And in space, you get into your very similar-looking Millennium Falcon fighting very much ripped off TIE fighters in a completely different game mode. Now you're kind of in this third person perspective down your ship, shooting all these different gun turrets left and right. And you've got different TIE fighters that will fly into view, and you've got to try to shoot them all to stop the Empire from advancing. The two different game modes in this is what makes it special. Going from a completely top-down perspective and flying through the canyon, and then making it up into space where you're fighting these TIE fighters in this unruly spaceship. Beautiful transition, beautiful fun. The shortcomings, of course, are mostly based on the system. There's only so much you can do. I think the canyon level loops a little too quickly. I wish there was a little more variety there. What's there looks awesome. Don't get me wrong. I just wish there was a little more canyon to explore, since you see it the majority of the time. And then space looks like space. You've got your stars out there, and you've got your TIE fighters swooping in, and you have a little bit more control of your ship. Real fun time, I feel. What did you think of this one, Aaron?
You know, I've got to tell you on this one. First of all, when it comes up, when this game comes up, the whole screen lights up and starts counting and running through all these characters. I was like, what in the heck is going on here? And then eventually it comes up and it shows you this backstory which I like. It tells you the whole backstory of what's going on. So it's all built into the game. I love games that do that. You kick off. Now, I didn't understand the rules at first. I can tell you now, having watched the video on this after the fact, the emulator I was using on this, it ran fine, but I couldn't fire bullets as quickly as I think I was supposed to, because I could never get off the first level. I had to watch video of the second level.
Oh, really? Unfortunate.
And I think it was emulator related, because I don't know about that. Maybe the key repeat wasn't on high enough, something like that. But the fact that this whole cavern is built out of existing characters, they did a great job with that. The whole the skull thing was cool. It was challenging to try to move your ship through it. I think the idea of having a number on the back of your ship to represent your shields is a great idea. Because it's not realistic, but I mean, in a game, you need to see what's going on. So it's utilitarian. You can see what's happening. I like that, man. It was a good choice. The ghosts or the ships or whatever you're shooting in the first level are not the easiest thing to take out, but it's doable, especially if you've got more bullets. I came close, and I was firing about 1/5 what I've seen other people firing at.
I think that the cavern section is very difficult. There are ways to cheese it. There are a couple ghosts that you can shoot every time without having to worry about getting hit. But then you have to worry about maneuvering the canyon every time, which isn't terribly difficult, but it does take a little bit of effort. This is not a game you're going to play for hours and hours and hours. You're going to get in there, you're going to experience the graphics in this thing, and you're going to fight to get to the second part. And once you do that, you feel accomplished, you want to try to get back there again. I never killed enough ships from the Imperial Invaders to complete the game, but my understanding is there's not a screen after that. And if there is, if someone's made it to it, please let me know. I'd love to. If there is one, let me know so I can go back and try to get past it. Everything works in this. And really, if you fly into the canyon wall, you don't just die. You start losing shield.
And it's sort of forgiving.
Nothing is a one-hit kill.
It's sort of forgiving. It's not going to, like, dock you a ton. You know, if you just sort of graze it, it might not even take any. You know, it's not too bad, all things considered. And, again, the fact that this was all done on this particular computer with its built-in limitations, I mean, this... I can imagine, you talked about the guy having the rolls of graphic, but I can imagine it, rolling it out and typing all that stuff up. I said, it reminds me of the old ANSI graphics you used to see on BBSs. I mean, a lot. it's almost like you're playing an ANSI graphic, which for me is great.
Yeah.
You know, a monochrome ANSI graphic. It's, again, that's something else we should mention. This is all monochrome. So, I mean, really, it doesn't limit what you can do. So both these games excelled in getting across what they were trying to come up with game-wise with the limited graphic sets and the limited color scheme. And plus, no sound. We should mention that as well. So, yeah, this was a winner. We got some Discord reviews on this one, Brent. We got a lot, actually, of Discord action this week, like I said. Z9K9 writes, "This game begins with some pretty badass graphic design. Walls of fractal skulls worthy of Brugel, hellscape, and angular megastructures made of either bone, stone, or gleaming metal. It's open to interpretation. If Psygnosis had made games for the ZX81, they might have been like this. The enemies have enough randomness to require some wit, though I found a fairly safe pattern to run eventually. It's a shame that the level ends not after a particular time period, but shortly after reaching 20 points. And neither is your remaining health carried across in any way, which makes your performance on this level somewhat redundant. The second level gives the impression of hurtling through space and seems like a solid target shooting challenge with an interestingly awkward weapon. Again, though, it's a shame that this game technically ends after this level, so that you must restart with 0 points instead of carrying it forward. 6 out of 10. From Z9K9.
I think that's well written and very expresses very much how I feel about the game as well.
Paul,
AKA
Hermsky, writes, "A Herm firm 7 out of 10. It's always difficult to score titles so far back when games are still very new in the home. What I do know is this game would have been super impressive back then. The fact that this game holds two completely different styles of level in one single load is a tall order for a computer like this. Many other games just loop similar levels, alternating speed, slightly changing layout, or throwing in different enemy sprites. I didn't get very far in this game, only managing to get to the second level once. However, when I got there, I was so excited to see something different, I lost track and died. Still, the game is not as good as the other ZX A1's classics like 3D Monster Maze and Flight Simulator, but it's better than most. So there you go. We've got Frodo and L chimes in. Ty, a nice ZX-A1 game I'd never even heard about. First impressions, basically a rather standard scrolling shooter that is saved by some great use of the ZX-A1 character set to create some rather stunning graphics in this first section. A not a very appealing second section, followed by the realization that that is all the game there is. After playing it, some more bugs show. In the first section, nothing flies into your ship from the side, making it too simple to complete that section. Shoot, I wish I'd known that. All you need to do is shoot the mines and avoid hitting walls. And then the worst one, an intermittent error that glitches so much that the second section is unplayable. Now, did you run into this, Brent?
I did run into this, and I don't know if it's a game issue or an emulation issue, but there are times when you reach the second part, and that's it. It's just a big glitchy mess. We did have one of our Discord followers state that they used a different emulator and was able to get to the second section many, many times without it glitching. So I do believe it could be an emulator issue.
Frodo continues, this could have been a way better game if it can only contain the first section with speed-ups or possibly some enemies with different patterns. As it is, though, the graphics in the first stage are basically what make the game 5 out of 10. I will say, when emulating the ZX81, I tried a couple different emulators, and really, it was a lot harder than I thought it would be, to be honest with you, to get these games to run properly. Like I said, I'm not sure I ever ran your game properly. So, good feedback this week on the old games. I think they were both interesting games, Brinster.
I agree.
I think the ZX81 surprised me quite a bit in terms of its game playing prowess. Now, we may have gotten lucky and picked a couple winners here, you know, but I looked at a bunch of other games that looked halfway decent. So there you go.
Yeah, there are certainly games for the ZX81 that are subpar, or, you know, people just didn't know how to use the power that was there. But And just to the reverse side of the coin, there were a few games out there that completely blew my mind, including, Aaron, I think you said you saw this too, someone had ported Dragon's Lair to the ZX81.
That was Jim Bagley, a very famous programmer. And if you ever watch the footage of this, he's loading this off of an SD card, some kind of SD hookup, but it's a monochrome miniaturized screen of the original Dragon's Lair. I mean, it is there. You can play it. Very impressive.
Yep.
Very, very unbelievable.
And using the power of the ZX81, it's not, I mean, sure, he's loading off a storage device that was never available at the time, but the actual processing power was being done by the computer.
I will say, the ZX81, not the best computer I ever saw, but the best sub-80-pound computer I ever saw, Brent, I have to say.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what else is like, the quality's okay. It's the freaking wheel. And here we go. Now,
uh-oh. You've angered the wheel, Aaron. Now we must
be
punished.
This week, Brent, we are going to be celebrating Halloween shortly. And so what we have put together is what I like to call the Wheel of Death. The Wheel of Death, Brent. Tell the people what the Wheel of Death is all about.
There's only one thing that can rip those lock pieces off the wheel for a week, and that is the Wheel of Death. It has summoned forth its demonic powers and has left us with only the absolute worst of the worst that we have ever covered here on the show. So we are now going to spin this absolute wheel of pain to see what
Let's go real quick what we've got here. We've got the CD32. That had Brent's all-time least favorite game. We had the Jag. The first episode Brent ever did, he hated that. We've got zombie games because it's seasonal, right? We've got the Mattel Aquarius, everyone's least favorite computer. We've got the Atari ST. Hey, listen, we had a crappy time on the ST. We're going to give it another shot. We had to bring this back because it was so horrible. And we just did it, but what the hell? The Commodore City TV. Commodore, two entries on the Wheel of Death. Everyone's least favorite episode of all time, black and white games. That's for you, Boat. We've got movie games. This is the pie piece that got kicked off YouTube, Brent. Boat, another Boat callback. Another one of his most hated episodes, the Xbox. Bizarro Spin, just to make it more painful. There you go. 10 brutal pie pieces. Are you ready for the spin, Brent?
Yes. I know what I absolutely don't want to come up. I don't think I can take another week of the CDTV. Anything else, I would consider
a
treat.
You take what you take, and that's just the way she goes. Here we go. What's the least thing you want the least, Brent, out of all these?
CDTV.
Okay. Here it is. Wheel of Death. The Halloween episode, Wheel of Death. The winner is, it looks like, it's the original Xbox. Oh, Lordy. Boat's favorite, Brent, will be here. We'll be doing another week. He's going to chastise me to no end when he sees this. You put that back on the wheel? Well, that's why we did it, Boat. The original Xbox, Brent. Could have been worse. That could have been worse.
It could have been a lot worse.
And I'm going to try to pick something that relates to the holiday here of Halloween. So next week will be our Halloween edition of ARG Presents. You know, the last holiday version of this we did, I believe, was that the one we did the
Williams
marathon?
Game.
You did the marathon game, and I think I did Sinistar. Yeah. It hungers, coward. So that's not too bad. So, I mean, the Amigas, we have a tradition of having horrible Halloween episodes. So hopefully we've got an ARG tradition of not having episodes that are so bad. So until next week. Boo-erns.
I was saying boo-erns.
Thanks for joining us today. We really hope you enjoyed the show. Quick shout out to all of our YouTube subscribers and Twitch followers. A special thank you to Duncan Styles for our vector graphics and Bartbit for our amazing music. Would you like to keep ARG spinning for as little as $1 a month? You can do so at anchor.fm/ARG-presents. Supporters get entry into the Amigos Discord channel, as well as their name called out in the credits. Supporters like these fine folks, Anthony Jarvis, Rand W. Metke, Terry Howard, Gary Heather, John Schaller, The Snow Norris, Bernhard Lucas, Frodo NL, Steve Rasmussen, Chris Fools, Mitsuyama, Retro Algae, Permsky, John Deckman, and Jerry Dennington. Don't want to explain another credit card bill? That's okay too. You can help us out by leaving us a positive review on Spotify and Apple iTunes. Have an idea for a wheel piece? Send it to us at argpresents@mail.com. We record live every Sunday at 9 a.m. EDT on Twitch. Hope to see you there.